Access number 3048, Mr. Eric Greg Robry, Reel 4. Now, you've just been working through the dates a bit, and there was a bit of a suspicion because of the cricket in April. But you now think that you went to Padgate in March, 43. You don't understand why you said January. That you were called up in June, 43. And that you were at St. John's Wood, therefore, June to July.
Yeah.
And then that you were at Bridgnorth, July to August. Although you're not saying those months are exact. Yet. You could be a month either side or anything.
Yeah.
But that's roughly right. And then, so what's the next thing you do? Because the next thing you do is to go to wireless school, isn't it? Now, which wireless school do you go to?
This one at Yatesbury.
So that's number one yeah. aircrew wing, number two radio school it is, and
yeah.
that's at Yatesbury.
Yeah.
Now, could you tell us what was the setup at Yatesbury?
The setup at Yatesbury, it was a radio school. All I did was train wireless operators, or signallers, as we were then called. And we were on a course, we were course number 22.
X-22,
which I thought lasted for 17 months. But I know we went there in either June or July, and we finished on, actually, we passed out, had our sergeant stripes on or just before D-Day, which was June the 6th.
So
that's definitely correct.
So if it was this 17 months, we've just been having to think about it, and it can't have been 17 months. You joined up in 42.
It's no, I didn't.
That, could, and you didn't. So
no, definitely not.
There's something slipped in the memory there, which is fine. And you're going to look before our next session to see if you can sort that one out. Now,
but
tell me
cricket
about
I'm talking about was at Lord's. You know, that was in the June.
That would fit.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't fit if you were joined up in December 1942.
No, but I thought when I was talking about Washbrook and Hutton, when I was at Bridgnorth, you were wondering why that could be the.
No, that's only if it's 17 months. If it's 17 months,
oh, yes,
D-Day, it pushes you back to.
No, I'm wrong about that, yes.
Right. Now, tell me about how did they start training you as signallers? Because that's what you're going to be called, you know.
At signals, we had aptitude tests.
Now, tell me about them, because you've had them before, but what are these ones?
Well, the first one was Morse code. We had one or two not so much tests, but they were assessing your ability with Morse.
So what's that?
And we had an individual little thing to do where they would transmit a simple message to you at a certain speed and see if you got it written down correctly. Then they'd go a little bit faster and so on. And try to find out what speed you are capable of achieving. Now, wireless operators using the Morse code, the really slick ones, can do 22 words a minute, some of them probably more. All that we were required to get up to was at the very least 6 words a minute, which sounds quite easy, but they were taking into consideration conditions in an aircraft, static and all the rest of it, and having to deal with different operators on the ground who all had their own, like your handwriting, you know, their method of sending was sometimes different to others.
You had to get used to a fist.
To remain at radio school, you had to at least achieve that 6 words a minute at the very minimum before you could continue on the course. As we went on, we got better and better.
So how did they train you in Morse? Was it the same method, just more of it, or
yes,
what were they doing?
We had we had, instructors who would transmit to you, different instructors. And we were asked to comment upon their different style of sending. Some were quite easy, and some were a little bit more difficult. But eventually, everybody got up to quite a bit more than the minimum speed of 6 words a minute. That was very low. I don't think there would be anyone got through that course with less than 12 to 15 words a minute.
How did you take, I mean, could you understand, I mean, Morse is supposed to be a bit of a knack and a bit like music. It's got its rhythm and things like
yes,
that.
Yes,
did you
it
find
is.
Yourself getting that, did you feel that way about it?
Or? Well, no, you get attuned to the signals. And most of the Morse transmissions to aircrew or think anything militarily are always in code. And in the Air Force, they had what was called a bomber code. And the bomber code consisted of blocks of 5 letters. That was all, 5 letters. Then a slight pause, another 5 letters, another 5 letters. And we had, that bomber code changed every day. It was different. So it was very difficult to break it down. And we were using, in training, the old codes that had been used, you know, and were no longer valid for anything because, you know, and the every day's code, we had a book or a sheet of paper when we flew with that day's code on, what the letters, the group of 5 letters meant. They were all alphabetically arranged. So accepting 5 letters in a code, and pour another 5 letters. It was quite easy to write down. We wrote them down in block print. And then you had time to quickly look them up in the bomber code, and each block of 5 letters was a phrase. Wind speed at such and such a place and height and all this sort of thing. That was the main thing that we did. We did often have to receive messages in, it's I suppose like texting on a mobile phone, or we just had to receive like email, you know, we had the full sentence and this sort of thing. But having learned the code, could identify every letter without any problem, you know, and very quickly, even that wasn't difficult. You know, after you'd been properly trained, that was easy enough.
And you got used to the coding and the
decoding. Oh, yes, you got used to the coding.
Now, what other training were you doing? Because I know you're in flying kits. So
there was that,
flying.
Yes. The sets that we used, we started off with the old transmitter and receiver.
Now, which one? Did they have a name?
Yes, it was the TR... and then almost something like 84, but I can't remember the number, transmitter, receiver, 84. And it was virtually two sets, one standing on top of the other. You use the top one for transmitting and the bottom one for receiving, sort of thing. And we had three wave bands we could use. There was high frequency, medium frequency and low frequency, which we called HF, MF and DF. With the old set, to switch to a different frequency, you had to change the coils in the set. Early wireless sets used to have coils, and you tickled them with a cat's whisker, if you remember. The very early ones. Well, the ones we were using weren't all that advanced from those. They were, as I say, in two parts. They're quite cumbersome to use in the aircraft.
Was it easy to tune in and, you know?
Well, it wasn't too bad. It was just the bother of knowing what coil you wanted. And if you were transmitting and then you wanted to receive, you'd have to transmit, change the coils over. You know, big things that were pulled out. But fortunately, we didn't use those for very long, but we had to know about them at radio school. When we got further on through radio school, we had the up-to-date sets, the Bendix equipment, Bendix Westinghouse, which was transmitter-receiver combined.
So that's bending...
Bendix, the firm Bendix,
B-E-N-D-I-X,
an American thing. Bendix Westinghouse, it was called.
And what was this wireless like? How did that operate? How did you operate it? What did you have to know?
It was a set that big.
Black. Now that's about what? 2 foot 6 by 4, or 2 foot by a foot?
Yeah, about 2 foot by 18 inches, maybe. And it had the low frequency coils down one side, high frequency on another. And it was used on a form of what were known as click stops. You could set on the low frequency level or the high frequency level any positions for ground stations that you knew you were probably be going to contact. In training on the Lancs, we had 10-hour flights where me and the navigator worked together, and he was always asking for bearings. We had to know which ground station we were close to.
I'll come to this a bit more, because
we would have those click stops fixed. So
they're
we
preset frequencies.
Preset
really?
Frequencies.
Yeah, you could click on them.
Click stops,
that.
Yeah.
Anything else about the Bendix Westinghouse? It sounds a lot simpler. Perhaps it wasn't.
Yes, it needed very little maintenance, but we had to know what things had gone wrong if certain things did go wrong, and know how to put them right if we could. And that was part of our training here. We had big classrooms set up with boxes set for each of the people who were in training. And they would put faults on the set. And you had to attempt to receive a message from them. For some reason you weren't getting it, or you're getting a lot of interference and all this sort of thing. And you had to, from your training, decide what was causing that and if you could put it right.
So that meant you had to know how wirelesses work. So there's
yes.
a big theoretical element here.
Yes, yes.
And
they were the sets we had were known as super heterodyne. For tuning in, you had a light in a little tube, a green light, which was going like this all the time.
Out
it was
in.
A dark shade of green and a light shade of green. And to tune an incoming signal in, you had to reduce that gap to as narrow as you could. You wanted the minimum gap or the maximum overlap, as they called it. That was called the magic eye. That was a feature of the Bendix that made it so much easier to use.
Mm-hmm. And anything else about the Bendix Westinghouse? How would you normally fix it? Would it normally be just replacing valves?
Yes, it could have been. We did carry certain valves, not the whole set. There was one valve that was capable of going off for no reason. It's called a double diode triode, and it was used in the grid bias section of the circuit. And the purpose of that valve, how can I put it? It was to boost the incoming signal. To provide bias on the grid, produce grid bias to enhance the incoming signal without causing oscillation. Because if you put too much bias on the grid circuit, the whole thing oscillates. But this double diode triode was the valve that you could replace that if that was the problem. That was the main thing. Another thing that was likely to go wrong, it was the 750 milliamp fuse. That was a little fuse, screw-in fuse, at the top of the set. It had a little hole there, you screwed it out. And you had to be very careful, because if you didn't take it out properly, you got a hell of a belt from it.
An electric shock.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So you're learning quite a lot about wireless here. Yeah. So you're not just learning how to tune in. You're learning the inside as well.
Yeah.
Now, what about the flying? Did you fly there? Because you're all in flying kit in the photograph you showed.
We didn't do any flying. Well, we did, actually. We didn't do anything at Yatesbury, this camp. There was an airfield there, but we didn't use it. But we went down the road, 3 or 4 miles, to Compton Bassett. And the second part of our training here was done mainly at Compton Bassett in two-seater monoplanes, the Piper Cub or something like that, where there was just me and the pilot. He was piloting me, and I had a program to get through and had to know which aerial to put out and which frequency to use and all the rest of it.
And were you enjoying that work?
Yes.
I mean, it's training for you. The pilot's just, I presume, driving you, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the pilot, you know nothing about it.
Did you enjoy the it's a Piper monoplane, do you think?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like, those flights?
They were never as far as the ones we did later in Oxfords and Anson's and Wimpy's, Wellington's. We're still, you know, quite early in our training, but we were on our own and we had to put things right that went wrong. One of the things, there were things called seven deadly sins of the WOPS on HD. Things that you should never do. And one of them, if you're using a low frequency, if you're flying at low level and you're working off a ground wave and you're using low frequency, you needed a trailing aerial, which is a massive length of cable with lead beads on the end, or copper beads on the end, trailing out to a number of yards behind the aircraft. That was all right, you know, above a certain height, but before you came into land, that cable had to be retracted. You had to wind it up from the side of your seat where you're sitting. It was quite a job, because the aircraft, if they landed without the hearing, it could have crashed. And it happened to me at Compton Bassett. not the first time I was flying with in the Piper Cub or whatever it was, with the second or third time. And the pilot took me up, we got up to certain heights, and I had to get permission from him to put the trailing aerial out. Got permission, correct height, put it out. I was busy going through my exercises, doing all I had to do, and I looked out the window, we were coming into land. I said, oh my God, the trailing aerial's out. And he hadn't told me that he was coming into land. He'd been recalled for some reason. And he'd never mentioned it to me. I managed to get in, but only a little bit of it. Unfortunately, it didn't do any damage to the aircraft. It just, you know, rattled along the it was a grass landing strip. And I had to make a report about it. And I was worried sick. I thought, it's going to go against me, this. But they told me not to worry. The pilot did not tell me he was going to land. It was him who got the blame. But there's all sorts of things like that that, you know, cropped up in training.
What were your wireless instructors like? Were they good? Did they know this stuff, or were they civilians?
Yes,
most
they were very good. The instructors, a lot of them were corporals. One of them, we could take his Morse messages better than we could listening to him talk to us. You know what I mean? He had a strange language, or South Country somewhere, but he gabbled. And in lectures, he wasn't all that good. But we didn't have a lot of him. But there was one of them who was extremely good. And we were always pleased when we were in his class. He was very clear. He had a sing-songy voice that was very clear and pleasant to listen to. Some of them, if you were at the back of the class, you were nodding off, you know, just because their speech was so boring. But most of them were very good.
And how did you get on with the other recruits? I should have asked you this earlier, but there's about 20 of you on this.
We all got together well, yes. Yeah, very well.
I mean, were they from the same sort of background as yourself, or, you know, better
mostly,
off or worse off?
Yes, mostly. At the end of this course, before we were posted to heavy conversion unit, you had your final exams, and if you gained more than 70%, I mean, the exams went on for about a week on different things.
Hang on, sorry, we're drifting away. We're talking about the recruits and how you got on with them. I mean, did you make any special friends with them, or, I mean, did you have any...
Yes, I made special friends with two because they came from Liverpool, the same as me.
Which two are they? Do you remember the name?
Yes, Whitelaw and Martin.
Was it just because they were from Liverpool, or...?
Yeah, we used to travel on leave together and meet up at the station to come back off leave.
And did you get on with all of them reasonably well, or were there any bullies amongst them, or any you just didn't like?
We all got on fairly well.
Doesn't matter, they can't see him, remember. As a bunch, you got on well. Would you help each other?
Yes, we certainly did.
And, right, tell me about these exams. There's nothing else. You were there about a year, from what we can see.
Yes, that could be right.
Whichever way.
Yeah, we definitely finished there on D-Day.
And tell us about the final exams, the tests. And how did they, what was this programme of examinations?
Well, we had to do work on the sets, putting right faults, you know, the practical side of it. We had to take a Morse exam. We had to... writing down, you know, had a sheet of questions and having to write down how certain things in the set worked, and if something went wrong, how we would put it right, you know, explain it in words. All sorts of things, you know, that we'd done.
Did you find the exams difficult?
I didn't, no. We used to sit up approaching the exams. We'd sit up in the billets, sit up on our beds, going through the manuals and, you know, revision, like you would do at university or college or anything like that. And we used to help one another, question one another and say, oh, no, that's not right, you know. This was the way it worked.
And what did you pass out as? Was there an option to pass out as an officer, or was it just you were all...
Well, I was getting to that before. All air crew passed out with the rank of sergeant initially. But if you received 70%, or if you gained 70% or more in your final exams, if you wished, you could apply for an interview. You can apply for a commission. I was one of the ones who got over 70%, along with about half a dozen more of us. And we had went before a board and had questions about mainly about our background. And all the other lads were saying, oh, you never get through. The only people who get through is if you've got a moustache or if you're a policeman. And the two of the half dozen or so on our course who did get through, one of them had a moustache and the other was a policeman. I don't know how true that rings, but that's what the saying used to be.
So you were rejected?
Well, I was able to apply because I'd received over 70%. Along with all the others who received over 70%. I thought, well, I'll go along, you know. But wasn't that definitely wanted to be an officer. I mean, they all used to say, oh, God, who wants to be an officer? You've got to pay for your own uniform, you have mess bills, you know. What they were really saying was you had to have some money behind you, you know, if you wanted to be an officer.
But you were turned out. They rejected you. You applied and they turned you down.
Yeah, well.
How did you feel about that?
Not all that bad. I mean,
it didn't worry.
It wasn't that we were actually turned down. We were interviewed. But two of them were recalled. Whether they had a second interview or not, I don't know. But the two who were recalled had been accepted. And I suppose then they could have either accepted or rejected.
But you were going to be a sergeant. Now, sergeant signaller, is that what it is? Or is
yes.
it a signaller
sergeant? All air crew were sergeants. Sergeant signaller, yes. Now, from then on, we had trade test boards. The further we went through our career in the Air Force, after 6 months you could undertake another test board and you could step up a rank each time. If you kept your nose clean and you're still doing your job, you got this advanced promotion. And I received promotion to flight sergeant.
But that's later on.
Yeah, when
but that was the system. You had a trade test,
and then
you get promoted to flight
eventually
sergeant.
Eventually, warrant officer. Right.